Et nous allons commencer par écouter Mary Petillo, qui est professeure de sociologie et d'études afro-américaines à l'Université Northwestern à Chicago. Mary s'intéresse aux questions de race et d'ethnicité. Et elle est surtout connue pour son livre « Black on the Block, The Politics of Race and Class in the City », qui est un livre primé, un livre qui analyse la gentrification et la transformation de l'habitat social dans un quartier noir de Chicago. Elle va nous parler tout de suite de questions raciales, pauvreté et planification des quartiers à Chicago, du New Deal au néolibéralisme, pendant une vingtaine de minutes.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks especially to the organizers for organizing, for supporting the conference, and for planning such a wonderful series of events. So it's really a pleasure to be here. Okay. So Newton Farr was the president of the National Association of Realtors in 1940, and he lived in the South Kenwood neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. The neighborhood is now a little bit famous because it's the home of President Obama. But back in the 1930s and 1940s, Newton Farr was working hard to make sure that someone like Obama could never move to South Kenwood. In addition to running the National Realtors Association, Farr was also the president of the Oakland Kenwood Property Owners Association in the late 1930s and 1940s. He aggressively fought racial integration of those neighborhoods, Oakland and Kenwood. He once called the method of the Ku Klux Klan in the south of the U.S., he called it extreme, but justified and certainly effective. Chicago's black newspaper, the Chicago Defender, deemed Newton Farr, quote, more than any single person responsible for keeping the city's expanding Negro population packed in their place. And that newspaper said that the organization that Farr ran was, quote, the wealthiest and most active anti-Negro organization above the Mason-Dixon line. In 1943, the Oakland Kenwood Property Owners Association, which Newton Farr ran, listed the following among their accomplishments for that year. Accomplishment number one, the eviction of undesirables, and just in case you don't know what undesirables are, they say explicitly Negroes, from dwellings at, and then they list a number of addresses in the neighborhood where they had evicted African Americans who had moved in. Their third accomplishment, the initiation of lawsuits to restrain sale to Negroes of four pieces of property. And then again, they list the addresses in the neighborhood where they stopped the sale of houses to black people. And they list three other accomplishments that sound very similar. In 1944, the Oakland Kenwood Property Owners Association spent $3,000 in legal fees to enforce racial restrictive covenants and to gather home signatures to create more racial restrictive covenants in the neighborhood. One of those racial restrictive covenants was on the house that I later bought in 1998 at 4432 South Berkeley Avenue. So here you see a picture of the house on the bottom. At the top, you see the original racial restrictive covenant with the signature of the homeowner and the address directly under it. And on the right, since you can't read the text in that document, on the right I have some of the text there. Restrictive covenants were legal agreements between white residents in neighborhoods across the country. And in these agreements, whites agreed not to sell or rent their homes to blacks, as you see in this kind of language. The restriction that no part of said premises shall in any manner be used or occupied directly or indirectly by any Negro or Negroes. And then goes on to specify, just to make sure, they also can't be sold to any trust that includes any Negroes, to any stockholders that include any Negroes, in no way sold or rented to blacks. So in my comments today, I'm going to bring us to this micro level of the city, the neighborhood, and talk about neighborhood planning as a tool of the development of the neoliberal city. The neighborhood is the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood, and it's on the south side of Chicago. And for those of you all who have read Black on the Block, this was actually part of the book that didn't make it into the book. So this is the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood. You have a whole map of Chicago up on the right-hand side, and so this is just a small excerpt. I will talk about the University of Chicago, which is just south of it. You see South Kenwood just south of it, and you'll see that it's along Lake Michigan on the south side of the city. Some major points just to get us all on the same page about the neighborhood, since this will come up in some of the historical material. North Kenwood, Oakland was nearly all white until about the 1950s, when in a matter of a decade, it became nearly all black. The racial change was swift, as it was in many other neighborhoods across the country at that time. I'll be talking about two historical periods, the 1930s when it was all white and the 1990s when it was all black. By 1990, Oakland was the poorest community in the city of Chicago. It had a poverty rate of over 70%, and North Kenwood was the third poorest with a poverty rate of over 50%. The neighborhood included many large public housing complexes and a lot of smaller affordable housing and other kinds of subsidized housing across the neighborhood. In 1985, the public housing was closed and all of the residents were moved out. And in 1998, the public housing was demolished. And much of the neighborhood planning efforts in the 1990s was about what to do with the residents who had been moved out and if to replace the public housing that was demolished. In the 1980s, middle class and professional African Americans started moving into the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood. And the neighborhood received significant public and private investments, including a designation of what's called a conservation area. And I'll talk about that a little later as well. And then finally, North Kenwood, Oakland, as I mentioned, is along Chicago's lakefront. It's just a mile from the University of Chicago, and it is just a 10-minute drive to downtown. And that is part of the reason why it received a lot of reinvestment. But the University of Chicago has played a prominent role in its development, and I'll talk about that in the later period. So I'm going to use the case of North Kenwood, Oakland, to make two points about the history of the neoliberal city. The first is that the rise of neoliberalism and the neoliberal city does not constitute so much as of a break from previous ideologies, planning, and policies, but rather an intensification of practices that have long been central to a capitalist political economy. In the field of housing in the US, the federal insurance of home mortgages in the 1930s and 1940s New Deal era was a huge public-private partnership, and that's often a buzzword we hear when we think about neoliberal cities today, this public-private partnership. But that's really what much of the New Deal funding was about, using public monies to support the investments of private banks into private households. And at the same time, to foster a new set of subjectivities. As our conference co-organizer Andrew Diamond writes, quote, "How can we discuss the adherence of Americans to neoliberal forms of reasoning in the 1980s without describing the ways in which federal housing policy cultivated a, quote, ownership society in the exurbs and suburbs of the post-war metropolis by making home ownership affordable to a whole new class of people," end quote. My story is not about those exurbs and suburbs, but instead about the neighborhoods and the people that were excluded during that time. The case of the 1930s shows the austerity of the state in matters of redistribution and racial equality. And again, that austerity is one that we talk about now when we think about the neoliberal city, but that austerity very much characterized the stinginess of the investments in public housing, for example, and the lack of investment in housing for non-poor blacks. And so we see that austerity in matters of redistribution and racial equality, but not in matters of lubricating the private sector. My second point is to begin with the explicit racism of Newton Farr in order to illustrate how much the discourse about race and neighborhoods has changed in this neoliberal era. Neighborhood planning is definitely not overtly for whites, as it was for Newton Farr, nor is it by and large assertively integrationist, nor is it stridently black nationalist, as it had been in the 1960s and 70s. Instead, neighborhood plans, especially when they're overseen by the city or the municipality, and definitely when foundations, private foundations, get involved, they often substitute vague and unspecified prescriptions that neighborhoods should be diverse. And that buzzword, diverse, is one that has started to get a lot of attention, scholarly attention, for how much it obscures. Even more, political scientist Lester Spence argues that under neoliberalism, anti-racism has become actually, ironically, a public principle. But he writes, however, quote, "The key distinction is that under neoliberalism, the most effective means of combating racism is developing entrepreneurial capacities in populations, institutions, and spaces that are non-white." So these entrepreneurial capacities among blacks and Latinos. So in words and slogans like choice and community capacity building, and again that ownership society mentality, blacks and Latinos are charged with solving their own problems and saving their own neighborhoods. And many black folks have bought into this form of governmentality. The North Kenwood Oakland case illustrates this growth of the do-it-yourself ideologies of the neoliberal city among middle-income and upper-income blacks in this post-civil rights era. As I will present, this can result in similarly exclusionary practices now directed at poor African Americans, those same practices that had been directed at blacks as a whole in the 1930s and 1940s. So I'm going to illustrate these two points using two short vignettes from the research in North Kenwood, Oakland. First, from the 1930s and 40s, and second, from the 1990s. So just so you have the map, I'll be talking about the Ida B. Wells Homes, which is up there at the very top of the map. And you'll see it kind of is on the, what would be the left side of Cottage Grove Avenue, and that'll be important, as I'll mention in a minute. The Ida B. Wells Homes. Ida B. Wells was a famous journalist and anti-lynching crusader in the U.S. and who lived in Chicago. The Ida B. Wells Homes was the first public housing built in Chicago for African Americans. The location was determined in 1934 by the federal government. But those federal outsiders were not ready for the controversy that their choice of location would stir among whites in the neighborhood. The northwest corner of Oakland, where part of this 1,600 housing unit development would be built, was at that time 90% black. In 1930, it was 90% black, so it was already predominantly black. But the area just on the other side of this dividing line, again, Cottage Grove, cut a very strong dividing line between this part of the neighborhood, which was all black, and this part, which was all white. The areas to the east of Cottage Grove at that time had black populations of less than 1%. So it was all white on one side, all black on the other side. And so the white residents of the neighborhoods were not happy with the choice for the siting of the Ida B. Wells homes. They argued that when they cleared the land to build this new public housing, it would push unwanted black families deeper into their neighborhoods. They said, quote, "We say that if the government desires to erect a housing project for colored families," colored was the term used at the time, "it should be over to the west of South Park Way, where the colored population has its schools, churches, and other social and civic advantages, and not placed at the gateway to the Kenwood and Hyde Park areas." A historian at the time wrote, "Feelings became so strained that some people feared a repetition of the massive Chicago race riots of 1919. In applying for federal funds to build the Ida B. Wells homes, the Chicago Housing Authority prepared a series of maps to illustrate where housing was being built in the city of Chicago. And those maps showed that it was all being built in the outskirts where whites lived, and that no new housing was being built in the black areas of the city. And thus, these Ida B. Wells homes were very necessary for blacks who were hungry for safe, decent, and affordable housing. But even more revealing of the discrepant patterns of austerity in black and poor neighborhoods and government subsidization in the outskirts and the growing white suburbs are these maps that the federal government made about where it would ensure loans, housing loans. So this map kind of looks like a big blur, because if you've heard the term redlining, which is the lack of investment, mortgage investment in neighborhoods, redlining comes from these maps, where whole parts of cities were color-coded, dark, dark red, lighter red, and these are not red. Whole parts of the cities were color-coded as places that banks would not make investments. And so here is the North Kenwood Oakland, here is the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood here. And here, as I showed you earlier, adjacent to it is the predominantly black South Side. So the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood, because it was adjacent to a black neighborhood, the federal government's manuals at that time recommended a lower rating when white neighborhoods were near what they called inharmonious racial groups. And as a result, the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood was given a C rating, or that was one rating above the D rating, whereas the South Kenwood Hyde Park neighborhoods, which are here, were given an A rating and opened for investment. And so what this did was, on top of the displeasing possibility of having a black neighbor, which the white residents of North Kenwood Oakland felt when the Ida B. Wells homes were being built, this FHA, or the Federal Housing Association lending geography, pulled whites to the edges of the city and the suburbs with the assurance of low-cost housing with long-term financing. This was already the case in the 1930s, but by the 1940s, it intensified, and the home building really took off, with 25% of all new homes in the Chicago area financed through this kind of mechanism. And so it's the areas that where new homes were built, you don't even see in this map, because this is the central part of the city of Chicago. What that created was the kind of racial change that North Kenwood Oakland experienced. In other words, by the 1940s, white residents had an exit option, and between 1940 and 1950, this is the black population in Oakland, between 1940 and 1950, we see the black population go from 20% to 70%, and then basically by 1960, both neighborhoods, North Kenwood and Oakland, are nearly 100% African American. So in this first period, we see the federal government incentivizing the market, but in a racially discriminatory manner. Historian Ira Katz-Nelson has referred to this era as, quote, when affirmative action was white. The investment in public housing was comparatively austere, and the support for black families outside of public housing was non-existent. So My second example is from the 1990s. It begins with an act, a legislative act in the 1950s. In 1953, the state of Illinois enacted the Urban Community Conservation Act of 1953. This was an urban renewal act that, in fact, South Kenwood and Hyde Park took advantage of to try to keep the black population from moving in. The language of this act read like any urban renewal act. For example, the beginning said, quote, these conservation areas are rapidly deteriorating and declining in desirability as residential communities and may soon become slum and blighted areas if their decline is not unchecked. And so the South Kenwood Hyde Park neighborhood drew their line in the sand at 47th Street to stop the movement of blacks from North Kenwood and Oakland into South Kenwood. If we fast forward to the 1990s, The residents of North Kenwood, Oakland, now at this time, are all African American, and they took advantage of the exact same legislation, this time to speed up the process of class integration. By class integration here, I mean encouraging black middle class and black professional families to move into what had been predominantly a poor neighborhood. This approach to neighborhood planning fits again with what political scientist Lester Spence has called, quote, the neoliberalization of black politics. Spence writes, quote, "We live in a period in which many of the central problems we face, problems that have political roots and political solutions, have been taken out of the realm of the political because blacks increasingly present these problems as technical problems that should be treated with very specific practices rather than as political problems that call for political organization and mobilization." I think this is a really important point about how neoliberalism focuses on technologies of planning as opposed to political mobilization. So this conservation area required the creation of a conservation community council, a governing board that would oversee planning and development in the neighborhood. This was a technical solution. The conservation plan was about density and building heights and commercial versus residential uses and parking and infrastructure. Obviously, this is not political mobilization. This is planning. It was not about disrupting the system of uneven development across the metropolis, where investment in one area often coincides with disinvestment from another. And it was definitely not about how black people, and especially poor black people, were always and often at the losing end of this investment and disinvestment spectrum. But here they were with a conservation area and the possibility of creating a conservation council, and people, the African American residents of the neighborhood, jockeyed to get on this council. The council was appointed by the city administrators and the mayor, and the council was advisory to the mayor's office and the planning office. Here we begin to see the role of the University of Chicago. There were 43 nominations for 15 positions, and the University of Chicago was going to make sure that who they wanted to be on this council would make it. They played a very active role in the process, and they promoted a particular leadership. I interviewed someone from the University of Chicago, and he narrated the events to me as follows. Quote, "We submitted names to the Department of Housing, and they came up with this awful list. I mean, I don't know where it came from. And so we had sort of an internal discussion, a fight with the city over that. So I said to the mayor's chief of policy, I said, I want you to meet with Shirley Newsom. She ought to be the chairman of the council, and she ought to help you figure out who ought to be on it. She knows everybody. And if not everybody's going to vote for the way I wanted, but at least she'll get a sense of the community on this point. So they met. I arranged for all three of us to meet on 57th Street, some kind of restaurant. And I just introduced them and I left. And he was very impressed. He had her in to see the mayor. As the history shows, Shirley Newsom became the chair of the Conservation Council. And this was the council that would oversee the plan for the neighborhood that would set the trajectory for how the neighborhood would be planned going forward. The first very controversial thing about the plan was what to do with the public housing developments that I mentioned that had been demolished. What to do, what to replace the units, how to bring the people back who had once lived in the neighborhood. And one of the key questions was, could people who did not live in the neighborhood serve on the council? Because the public housing residents who had been moved out did not live in the neighborhood anymore, but yet because they wanted to be planned back into the neighborhood, they wanted to be on the council. I have a relatively long quote from a representative from the public housing developments who staked his claim to be on the council and to have representation on the council. But given the time, I won't read the long quote, but I will end the story by saying he lost. There were no public housing. It was determined that if you did not live in the area, you could not be on the council. And as a result, there were no former public housing residents on the council. And as you can imagine, then, the plan reduced the number of public housing. There were 700 units that were demolished in this development, and the new plan was to rebuild 150 on the site where those 700 had once stood. So I will conclude. The ultimate irony of this story is actually its major takeaway. North Kenwood, Oakland's African-American residents in the 1990s chose a neighborhood planning strategy, this conservation area, that was in its first incarnation in the 1950s utilized to keep black people out. Indeed, some black middle-class leaders even partnered with the same organization that had worked to keep them out of South Kenwood and Hyde Park in the 1930s and 1940s, that is the University of Chicago. And their neighborhood planning process became technical rather than political. They became part of the ownership society. They became entrepreneurial citizens. They embraced a notion that they could do it themselves. And in so doing, they erected new barriers of exclusion, this time based on class, not race. They planned out the black public housing residents. They turned away from collective political mobilization toward the technical details of neighborhood planning. They fiercely claimed ideological allegiance to the ownership society mentality from which they had been so vehemently excluded during the New Deal and after. The North Kenwood Oakland story shows how both the neoliberal city was forged in a past more distant than the 1970s, but also, and perhaps more worrying, how its future seems ever more secure as even groups who in many ways had and have been victims of its policies now utilize its technologies and its forms of governance. And I'll stop there and hope I made it somewhere close to time.
Perfect. Thank you.